The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week,
at the end of hearing the intuition pump, you sort of pound the table and say, got it, yes, wow, that's got to be right.
I'll be joined by Daniel Dennett, a philosopher and writer whose work is focused on the mind and the philosophy of science. He'll discuss his new book, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking, a sort of greatest hits of useful philosophical things which he claims can help you win friends and influence people. And?
I don't know what it is about
big
that.
Big audiences? Do you get big audiences?
Oh, yes. 800 people will turn up to see Alok Jha.
Just me, do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, just you.
Ahead of this year's Cheltenham Science Festival, science writer and broadcaster Vivian Parry tells us why she thinks the festival is a must for Science Files. And along with Vivian, I'll be joined by Observer science editor Robin McKee to discuss some of this week's big science stories, including growing concerns over the H7N9 virus and the oldest bird in the world. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Time now to discuss some of this week's big news stories in the pod today. We have the Observer Science Editor, Robin McKee. Robin, welcome.
Hello.
And a long-time absentee from this pod, Vivian Parry. How are you, Vivian?
It's an unalloyed pleasure to be here.
And a pleasure to see you too. Robin, you've brought a lovely story for us this week. This is about the oldest bird ever found.
This is correct. This is found in China. It's 160 million years old and therefore 10 million years older than Archaeopteryx, which was the previous incumbent with that title. It's known as Dawn, shall we just say. I'm not going to try and pronounce what it
is. Go on, give it a go.
Oh, God, you would. Auroronis Xui.
That's not bad.
Found in China, intriguingly enough, not found in situ, but found from a dealer who had it in his shop, which gives all sorts of problems of provenance with the thing. How do you know where it came from? How do you know what sediment bed it's in? And therefore, if you don't know the sediment bed, how old it is. And age is very crucial to this particular discovery.
There's a big trade, isn't there, in fossils in China, given that, well, China's become this place in the last decade or two where just dinosaur after dinosaur is turning up. It's an incredibly rich scientific resource. And there's people selling fossils. And then the fossil upon which this is all based, the Nature paper, is absolutely beautiful. You can see this bird sort of skeleton splayed out there. It almost looks unreal. And so therefore, you've got to be very careful, right?
Here's one I made earlier.
Well, exactly.
Well, this has happened. Somebody had to retract a paper a few years ago because it turned out it was actually glued together by some dealer.
You mean epoxy resin wasn't around?
Well, there was a little screw top inside it there. They should have spotted that, really.
It's a big danger.
Yes, it is a big danger. So, to be fair, from the reports we're reading about this, they've gone to great detail to check that it's, you know, there isn't little pins and needles and bottles of glue lying and everything, but it was incredibly detailed, and they found little bits of fur, which are kind of feathery fur, that suggest that indeed this was the earliest bird. And they found the sediment bed. They checked the sediments in the sample with the sediments there. It looks good, but there's always this very still this slight question mark hanging over it. Nevertheless, it's a great discovery.
Let's assume that it is true. I mean, it's published in a leading scientific journal. So let's assume it is true. 150 million years old is what Archaeopteryx was. This is 160 million years old, so considerably older.
Yes.
What does it tell us about the evolution of birds and flight then?
Well, it's older than we thought.
Apart from that obvious statement. Come to you for the insights, McKee.
It couldn't actually fly, this bird.
No, that's right.
It didn't actually have feathers. It had this kind of fluff.
They think by the look of it.
Why
they
called it Dawn or Down. It should
Dawn,
be.
Dawn, but you're quite right. It's about the size of a pheasant. And pheasants can fly. This one apparently couldn't by the look of it. What does it tell us about the evolution? Well, it confirms what we have always, you know, one lineage of dinosaurs eventually turned into the lineage that we now have as birds. And yeah, it confirms yet another important fossil that nails that story down.
And it's one of those big things, isn't it? The reason I sort of got exercised about whether it's real or not is, I mean, the idea of the first bird in the evolution of life on Earth. It's quite a big moment. So this is going to be argued over, and people are going to try and continue to sort of knock it down. But that's just the way of science, I suppose.
Yes. The interesting thing is, do you evolve a bird on the ground that gets big enough to fly? That doesn't seem logical. What you would expect for flying creatures to start off very, very small and then get bigger. So exactly how this creature came about is an interesting story, and quite clearly we don't know the origins of it.
Actually, there's a very interesting parallel here, isn't there, with Mary Anning, who was the great fossil hunter of the 19th century, and she was the person who discovered all those dinosaur bones around Lyme Regis. And actually, she became very knowledgeable, but because she was a woman and had no education, she was kind of relegated, and her skills and her knowledge was really not taken seriously. But I guess these fossil hunters of today in China, they must have similar sorts of skills, because if you find something like that, you have to have some knowledge to know that it's special,
don't
you?
Something, because if you uncover something useless, you're not going to get it. So you can go up to all these scientists and go, psst, do you want some bones, mate? And you've got to have the real, you've got to have the good bones, then, and you've got to have the knowledge and the eye to know.
How much these things cost? You know, what does it? Well, how much can you sell a genre-defining fossil for?
Well, presumably the guy didn't know it was genre-defining or paradigm-shifting dinosaur when he actually said, he just thought it looked
kind of nice.
Yeah, quite nice.
And I suppose maybe the paleontologists themselves don't pretend not to care. It's like, oh, it's just another fossil, when they can see that it's something amazing possibly in there.
It's crap. Knock you down to 50 quid.
Knock
it
down to 50 quid. All right, well, let's move on from the first bird to bird flu. See what I did there?
Yes, very good.
Vivian,
good.
Tell us about... This is a very serious story, so just serious hats on, people. Tell us about the latest cases of this new bird flu, H7N9, which has been spreading, sort of worrying people slightly. It now seems to be resistant to some antivirals.
So we first see H7N9 in April, so really not very long ago. There have been 131 cases, 36 deaths. So this is a flu that has a very, very serious mortality rate. And there's a paper in The Lancet this week. They looked at 14 patients. All were treated with antivirals, and treatment failed in 3. Now, that's very, very concerning, because we have very few antivirals as it is. Tamiflu is probably the best known, but there's also one that's called Relenza. And if this flu is already becoming resistant to the antivirals we have, then actually there's nothing in the cupboard to treat it with. I mean, there's been all those problems that people have been talking about with Tamiflu, for instance, and, you know, did it or did it not really reduce the rate of complications? But actually, I was on the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation during the pandemic, and one of the things that exercised us was that people have to know that there is something that you have in the cupboard, even if it's not very good. It's better than nothing.
It's worth being clear that antivirals don't cure you of flu.
No, absolutely
not. Nothing
can
kind of do that.
No, they don't. They just make it... there are two uses for them. The first is as prophylaxis. So if somebody gets it, you give it to all the people around and hope that it doesn't spread. And that's only worth doing right at the very beginning of a flu outbreak. But later on, you're giving it to people to try and lessen the severity of complications.
And give them
in
a
other
fighting
words,
chance.
Yes, it makes the difference between living and dying for those that are really seriously ill.
Now, bird flus come and go, and we've been worried about them for years and years. H5N1 back in 2009 spread from Mexico to US to America to the UK. It was called a pandemic by the World Health Organization. In the end, it sort of kept itself from spreading too far. Every year we worry about a new one. How worrying is this one?
I think this one is really concerning. I mean, I remember back in time when H5N1 was a worry. And the thing was, we were sitting there hearing these reports from Mexico of very high death rates in hospitals. And what we didn't know at the time was that actually an awful lot of people had been infected and didn't show any signs of infection. It's possible that this is the case with this one, that lots of people have been exposed and very few people have become seriously ill. And we're just seeing the kind of that tip of the iceberg, as it was. But on the other hand, the thing that's really worrying about this is that it's already showing resistance to antivirals. And the other thing is that it's got several of the mutations already that are known to increase its transmissibility.
So at the moment, it doesn't transmit between people, which is the real killer
step. Except very close contact.
Yeah, except very close contact. But that's the real killer step that we're worried about when it comes to bird flu, is really going from one species to all.
And it's already got some of the steps it needs.
Yeah. And so, I mean, Robin, you write about these things often. We've kind of covered pandemics as they happen. How worried? I mean, Vivian says we should be worried about it. I mean, how worried are you about these sorts of flus that come along?
You've got a feeling one day it's coming. It's just, if it's not this one, it's something related to it farther down the line, and there will be hell to pay. I mean, what I'd like to know is what are the state of vaccine preparations for this strain?
Well, people are wanting to develop a universal vaccine for flu, and there's been, I think it was the company with Sanofi, earlier this week reported some progress, but it's in animal studies, and it's certainly not where they would want it to be yet. Vaccination on a grand scale requires preparation in eggs, usually, and one vaccine takes one egg. And of course, if you've got luckily actually with this one, it doesn't seem to kill chickens outright. But imagine there you are preparing a vaccine in eggs, and actually chickens are the very thing that are killed by the virus. So it's really tricky. And even now, there are flocks of chickens kept in aseptic conditions. I think there's one in Speke up in Liverpool, where they're protected from overflying birds and all sorts of things, ready for production of flu vaccines as and when they're required.
This is like, these are army chickens.
Army chickens, yes. Pressed into the service of the nation.
But vaccines are one thing, but surely when it comes to the fact that we can't make vaccines quickly, as you say, the more important thing becomes organisation and the World Health Organization sort of pandemic planning. If this starts to spread, then they're the ones that are going to have to prepare, you know, border controls and send information out quickly and make sure that people are quarantined. I mean, this is actually becoming an important issue in pandemic planning nowadays, isn't it?
I think actually we're reverting to the 19th century. I mean, the public health measures of those days are as important now as they were then. So when you have an enormous number of people, you can't possibly even if you had the flu vaccine, you know, and you had stacks and stacks of it and enough for everybody, it would physically take longer than the wave of the flu coming through to actually get through vaccinating everybody. I mean, we've even seen that with MMR, you know, all these people wanting to have vaccines, and actually it's a relatively slow process.
The trouble is, with the 19th century, there was maybe a billion people on the planet. Now there's seven, and we're heading for 10.
And of course, we rush across the world in aeroplanes,
yes.
And we spread flus very quickly.
All right. Well, I don't want to worry everyone. Let's
apart from that's good news.
Thank you for that, Vivian. Let's stay with you for the next section then. You're here to also tell us a bit about the Cheltenham Science Festival, which will be happening later this week. This is a jamboree of scientific happenings and lectures and explosions and all sorts. Tell us a bit about the what you'll be up to there.
I bow to no one in saying it is the top science festival.
Well, that's your opinion.
Yes, my opinion, I'll hold to that. It is a fantastic week for anyone, and there's something for everyone. I seem to be involved in about 8 or 9 events, but the ones I wanted to tell you about was, first of all, I'm doing something called Just So Science. I did a programme or a series of programmes for Radio 4 at the beginning of the year, which seemed to get down very well, about the science behind the animals of the Just So stories. And I'm now going to, since we've run out of animals for these stories, we're going to look at some new animals. So what we thought we'd look at is Animals whose extreme physiology makes them of special interest to human health.
So we're not talking extremophiles then?
Not extremophiles, vents. But things like axolotls. And axolotls are these weird-looking salamanders. And if they get a leg chopped off, they retreat behind a stone and they grow a new leg. And axolotls are now studied intensively because of their great interest in regeneration and how they do that.
So this is the Wolverine of the animal world.
The Wolverine world. Of the animal world. And then I'm also looking at the fantastic Tasmanian devil. And Tasmanian devils have been decimated by a transmissible cancer that spread from one to another. Because if you're a Tasmanian devil, the very first thing you do when you see another Tasmanian devil is you go up to it and go, and bite it. That's what they do.
I do that. I mean, that's just why.
just settle down. Anyway, so they spread this cancer between them. But it turns out that the way that the cancer is transmitted within a population of Tasmanian devils is the same way that cancer metastasizes in the human body. So now it's become an object of a real serious discovery, places like the Sanger Center.
That's fascinating. I can't believe that. I mean, the actual story of Tasmanian devils and their decimation is desperately sad, given that they're the childhood cartoon heroes for many of us.
Yes.
But the fact is that these tumours on their faces are, I mean, you see the pictures of them, they're
horrible,
heartbreaking.
Horrible.
Aren't they?
Can I raise the pedantic point? Do we mean decimated or do we mean much
worse? I think the Guardian Star Guide says you can say decimated when you mean wiped out.
Okay, fine.
Say, yes. doesn't mean one in ten.
But my favourite of these animals is perhaps bats, because we have a wonderful scientist coming called Steve Lacomba, and from Queen Mary, and he studies the foraging behaviour of bats. And it turns out that it is exactly the same way that serial killers go after their victims.
Oh, go on, tell me how.
And so if you study the same algorithms that you use to find out where bats are going to go next in their foraging can be used to detect where a serial killer is going to go next.
I don't know how that's going to work, but that's why they have to come to your session to find
that's
out.
So
absolutely.
Let's not,
and
let's
what
not spoil
we're wanting
it.
Is we're wanting people to write an 800-word story based on the style of Rudyard Kipling about that particular animal. And we have five scientists all trying to persuade the audience that their animal should be the subject of a Just So story.
Okay, fantastic. Oh, fantastic. Give us a rundown of a couple of other of these sort of more wonderful highlights of the week.
Well, there are some wonderful highlights, but I'm going to talk about my events.
Are you going to talk about
yours? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Just I'm going to be ruthless about this. There's a very good event on sleep. I'm doing an event on what's normal immune system. We're doing something on Jane Austen and medicine in her day, because as you'll all know, if you're lovers of Jane Austen, whenever a heroine gets wet feet, the next thing she's down with brain fever and at death door. You can always guarantee that.
Diagnosing people from Jane Austen novels?
Diagnosing people from Jane Austen novels and finding out what her experience and knowledge of illness in the 18th century was.
And on Lyme Regis Beach, as I recall, from Pride and Prejudice.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, Lydia, that's where she went.
Yes, and has the fall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is this all intriguing you, Robin?
But if
it's all part of a pattern. I'm seeing everything's connected in this show.
But of course, if you really want top quality, there is Dara O'Brien. There is the Science Club, and there is the one and only Anne Lockjar.
Am I involved?
You are involved.
No one
I think.
Told me. but tell me something, Vivian. Science festivals in my youth were a bit of a cheesy thing you did with your parents, dragged you along to. What's different about Cheltenham? Why are we interested in this all of a sudden? You seem so excited about it.
Because it is genuinely exciting, and because the audience really get into it. I don't know what it is about
big
Cheltenham.
Audiences. Do you get big audiences?
Oh yes. I mean, some of these audiences. You, of course. You know, 800 people will turn up to see Alok Jha.
Just me? Do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, just you. It's extraordinary.
I've paid them all. You realise?
But they do come along, and they are really interested. And I think perhaps because it's all in one place. Because people really love the science festival, they kind of know what to expect, and it's going to be really great entertainment and good value and intriguing. The sort of thing that people come away and you can see them talking to each other saying, I never knew that. I never knew that.
Do you know what I think is interesting about these sorts of things? And I say this about book festivals, science festivals, Edinburgh, all of these actually, is access to scientists. I'm kind of, and all of us around this table are very lucky. We get to talk to really interesting people all the time, scientists and others. But if you're out there doing your day job and you're reading about all these things and you're excited about them, you read the books, to meet the person who wrote the book or has discovered this fossil that we've talked about earlier, or is looking at pandemic strains of flu, and to get that sort of interaction with them and get them to answer some of your questions, I mean, that's fantastic.
And this year at Cheltenham, we have the extraordinary James Watson.
Yes, you do. He'll be interesting.
He'll be interesting.
He will be interesting. Have you got someone to make sure he doesn't say anything rude or bad?
Well.
Do you have a minder?
Well, he's being interviewed by Matt Ridley, so I hope he's possibly...
No, he is a fascinating person. And and the fact that he says whatever he thinks is probably part of the fact that he's fascinating and interesting.
But, you know, there is a man who has a genuine and richly deserved place in history. I mean, and you have the opportunity to talk to him directly, as you say.
It's fantastic. The Cheltenham Science Festival is on from Tuesday this week and until Sunday. There's all sorts of things. If you go to our website, there'll be a link there. And it's not just talks by scientists. There's lots of things you can take part in. There's video clips and all sorts of things. And parties. Apparently, it's just all parties, as far as
is
I can gather.
Oh, I know you don't go to parties.
Many thanks there to Vivian Parry. Cheltenham Science Festival kicks off on 4th of June, and their site for details is cheltenhamfestivals.com. For all of Robin McKee's fine writing, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher based at Tufts University in Massachusetts. His work over four decades has seen him tackle everything from the philosophy of free will to that of evolution and cognitive neuroscience. A great proponent of science, he's made important contributions to the way scientists think about their work and how it relates to the world around them. His latest book is called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. It's a sort of greatest hits manual of his ideas. He came into the studio to tell me all about them. Daniel, thank you very much for coming in. Can I just jump straight in and ask you, what is an intuition pump?
It's a persuasion device. It's a little scenario or story, a little imaginative exercise. Some of them are formal arguments, but very few. Mostly they're just little vignettes which highlight some issues. And if they work, at the end of hearing the intuition pump, you sort of pound the table and say, got it, yes, wow, that's got to be right. Now, that's the intuition. It's a conviction that you arrive at and are provoked into, and you don't really know how you got there. It's not by following the formal steps of an argument. It's just revealed to you by the denouement of the story.
So it's a realization moment that you get at the end of one of these things. Give me an example. I mean, there's scores in the book, and I wish we could just go through them all, but we can't. But so give we're going to go through some of the highlights then in that case. Give me some examples of these things.
All right, let's do the two lotteries. In lottery A, the tickets are sold, and after the tickets are sold, the winning ticket is chosen, and the winner gets the money. In lottery B, exactly the same, except that the winning ticket is chosen before the tickets are sold and hidden off in a safe, let's say. Now, question, are those lotteries equally fair? Do you have an equally good chance and opportunity to win? Would you be a fool to buy a ticket in the second lottery, for instance, because the winning ticket has already been put in the vault? No, you wouldn't be. You still have a chance. Now, what does this show? It shows that people who do, in fact, respond this way almost universally are smarter than the philosophers who think it matters when the randomness occurs, when the choice occurs, in order to have an opportunity. If determinism is true, then all your lottery tickets were basically chosen back at the time of the Big Bang, and you dole them out as you need them during life. And if you think, well, wait a minute, but that means that I'm determined sometimes to have good luck and sometimes to have bad luck. Yeah, that's true. So what? The same thing's true if indeterminism is true. It's still going to be the case. Sometimes you're going to have good luck, sometimes you're going to have bad luck, and if you can't tell, it doesn't make any difference. So that's a little intuition pump which is designed to shake the very widespread confidence that people have that free will and opportunity require indeterminism. And it shows, no, even in a mundane example like a lottery, even though something can be already established in the past, doesn't mean you don't have an opportunity.
I mean, that example is there's something deeper there than the usual way that perhaps someone would deal with those questions in those two lotteries. If someone said, here are two lotteries that work like this, which one would you go for? The usual sort of, maybe let's say, unscientific way of looking at it would be, well, you don't understand risk perception. You don't understand probabilities to know that actually the probabilities of winning are identical for both. And, you know, the results are the same. And so if someone chooses one over the other, then the standard argument would be, well, you don't understand risk. And that's something we talk about a lot. Risk, not understanding risk is a regular thing for people. So in a sense, is your intuition pump idea, this deeper thing, meant to say, well, actually, it doesn't matter whether you understand these probabilities or not. You inherently can get more out of these situations if you just think about them in this slightly philosophical way rather than having to think about numbers and probabilities.
It's a philosophical thought experiment that illuminates an issue which can be dealt with scientifically in actually several different sciences. We can look at indeterminism in physics, and we can look at models of deterministic chaos. And the crux comes when the sciences and the way everyday folks live and think, when these come into contact and we get puzzles. You know, are colors real? Well, it's all just electromagnetic radiation in a particular spectrum. Does that mean that colors are an illusion? Most people would say, no, that's not the way to think of it. They're not really an illusion. They're not what you think they are, but they're not an illusion. Color is perfectly real, and free will is perfectly real, even if it isn't what you initially thought. There are many areas where the ideas that we've had around for thousands of years in everyday talk come into conflict with new understandings, new perspectives that science makes possible. Whose job is it to unite those two, to build bridges across the gap between everyday folks' talk, what Sellers called the manifest image, and the scientific way of thinking about it? It's not the scientist's job. They do it rather poorly. Some of them do it very well. It's the philosopher's job to negotiate between those two worlds.
Let's have some more examples, shall we? Now, another one you've got is, I mean, I've heard of Occam's razor, which is a way of trying to find the simplest possible interpretation of an action, event, or an argument. But what's Occam's broom?
Yes. The great biologist Sidney Brenner, funny man, came up with this a year or two ago, very recently. Occam's broom is what you use to sweep inconvenient facts under the rug.
Subterfuge, then.
It is. And he was talking about how, in the heat of battle, scientists do this without realizing it. They just, there's a study or two that, yeah, they know about those studies, and yeah, the results really don't favor the view that they're defending, but they sort of forget to mention that in the heat of battle. That's the sort of innocent use of Occam's broom. But polemicists and propagandists use it very effectively by, say, a conspiracy theorist can put together a beautifully persuasive case for some conspiracy by simply leaving out a few facts that aren't common knowledge. Only an expert can notice that they're missing. The uninitiated can be completely suckered by such an explanation that looks so reasonable.
Is this an extreme form of cherry picking, then?
Oh yeah, it is. And actually, it's, in a way, it's sort of the inverse of cherry picking. It's deliberately not picking the cherry bombs, the things that are going to go against you.
Yeah, so they're leaving the rest there. Yeah. And why is that? I mean, knowing that exists, of course, is very useful when you're arguing with someone or reading a scientific paper or reading an argument or something, yeah. Knowing that cherry picking exists. But how does that help you then to interpret and work out the argument without then going off and doing your own research? Because that's the kind of only solution to that.
There isn't any short way of doing it, but this is something I've learned as a philosopher interloper in many different scientific communities. I have learned to be cautious about simply taking at face value the things that I seem to be taught by these people in their published papers. Usually, if I go to the lab and actually see the circumstances, I will suddenly see that I was slightly misimagining what the setup was. Not because they're cheating or they're misdescribing. There's things that go without saying in the published work that I just didn't know. And once I see what is actually involved, I come away with a somewhat modified view of what's going on. That, by the way, is why a journal like, say, Behavioral and Brain Sciences is so valuable, because you get a target article which sets out some fairly bold hypothesis, argues for it. And in the very same issue, you get the reactions of 20 or 30 experts in the relevant fields, and you can immediately sort of make book on the authors and see, well, how seriously do their peers take this? And absent that immediate surround of context, be very hard to know how seriously to take some of the stronger claims that are made in that journal.
Just a couple more examples before we go into how all of this can be useful for us mere mortals and perhaps scientists as well. Let's go to one or two more examples. You recommend that people should answer rhetorical questions. Now, of course, rhetorical questions are special in that you're not meant to answer them.
Yeah. Well, why don't you answer a rhetorical question? The answer is supposed to be obvious. It would be embarrassing to answer the question. But that means that there is implied a reductio ad absurdum or something very much like it in the background. And the author just won't be bothered spelling it out, thinks it's beneath notice. Well, sometimes that's the weak point. Go ahead, risk embarrassment, spell it out for me, please. Well, the way you can do that is by simply silently to yourself when you see a rhetorical question, try answering it, just flat out answering it. And you may find that you're not so embarrassed to answer it after all. In the Peanuts cartoon strip, one of my favorites, Charlie Brown says in the next to the last panel, "Who's to say what the difference is between right and wrong?" And Lucy in the last panel says, "I will." And okay, well, now we've changed the subject. Now we have to see whether or not she's right, that she has the capacity to say.
It's funny you mentioned Peanuts. It seems to be the philosopher's choice in terms of cartoons.
Well, I don't know. I actually, more recently, I've been quoting Dilbert a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Between cartoons in general, in that case, where panels say these things. I mean, but the example you give there of answering the rhetorical questions is something which is very childlike in a way. It's what children do all the time, and somehow at some point in their early years stop doing. Is that a mode of thinking that you would encourage more people to take?
Well, yes, I guess it is. I never thought of it in those terms. But one of the things I've noticed again and again in my career of hanging out with all sorts of smart people is a lot of the smartest of them are very childish in their enthusiasms. They never lost their childlike enthusiasm for what they're doing, whether men or women. They're boys and girls having the greatest of times. And it's pretty clear that this attitude, this childlike attitude towards reality, stands them in very good stead. It makes them open-minded. They tend to have more bright ideas. They make mistakes more often, maybe, because they go running off with one half-cocked idea or another. But I think it's really quite wonderful that these sort of superannuated children do so much of the good work in science.
So that leads me nicely onto the next section, which is that your philosophical ideas have been used in science. You've taken stuff from science for all of your career. First question is, why philosophy rather than science for you? Why didn't you just do science?
I think it had more to do with my familial upbringing, the fact that I was born into a non-scientific family and had some very good science teachers in school, but thought of myself as probably being a historian or a philosopher or a novelist or something like that instead. And then gradually just the fascination of scientific ideas and their relevance to philosophy was borne in on me, and there was no turning back. I just realized. And at that point, it would have been awkward and time-consuming as a graduate student to go back to school and simply shift gears altogether. So I began sort of training myself, autodidact, but more importantly, along the way, I had some wonderful volunteer tutors in every field that I was interested in who took an interest in informing me, steering me away from enthusiasms that were misguided, and generally trying to bring me up to a working knowledge of their field. So it's been a fabulous impromptu education.
Do you need a detailed understanding of like the edges of science, you know, quantum physics, or and you talk about, a lot about evolution and free will. I mean, so do you need a detailed understanding of, you know, the mathematics of Darwinism or neuroscience, that proper, real, cutting edge stuff to then come up and apply philosophy?
I think you do need it. I don't have enough. I often find myself immeasurably short on understanding some of the technicalities, and then I have to get help, further help. I'm happy to say there's a new generation of younger philosophers of neuroscience and cognitive science and philosophers of biology who really know the fields very well. They are completely comfortable with both the theoretical and the experimental literature. Very often they have lots of lab experience, which my lab experience is delicious, but all sort of secondhand. I get to design experiments, but I never have to run them.
Do you think that that science needs philosophy?
I do.
Well, let me ask that question another way. What purpose does philosophy fulfill for scientists who, you know, maybe just mixing reagents in a lab, or you know, working out whether a mouse does this behavior or that behavior? I mean, what purpose does it solve?
My sort of thumbnail definition of philosophy is it's what you're doing whenever you're not quite sure what the right questions to ask are. And that can come up in any field. Now, when you do know what the right questions are, that is within some truncated exploration, go ahead, answer the questions. You don't need philosophy for that. And there are a lot of people who really are uncomfortable in the sort of murky, slippery world where you're not quite sure there are any fixed points, you're not quite sure what the right questions are. And so they can go ahead, they get their questions, you know, ready-made on the rack, and they can go answer them. Fine, that's good work. There's a lot of work for everybody. But in every field, as far as I can tell, I don't know, I'd have to think hard to see if geology has any really philosophical questions. Maybe it doesn't. But certainly in biology and in physics, heaven knows, and even in mathematics, there are some very puzzling quandaries around the edges that people still have to struggle with or resolutely turn their back on them.
But is the philosophy of science, as some people might caricature it, just the absence of science in a particular area?
Sense, that's right, but that's not a criticism. If you go back to Aristotle's day, there wasn't any science. So Aristotle was creating sciences as he went along by getting one or another question clear enough so that you could begin to make some empirical progress with it. As time has gone on, more and more questions have become clarified enough so that now they're scientific questions, proper scientific questions. If you look at psychology, we can see that it's only been 100 years and change that the field has existed as a science at all. And some people would say it was a little premature birth, that they should have gotten a few more of their questions clarified before they launched the science. And look at the 20th century. We had what were ultimately quite philosophical battles between cognitivism and behaviorism, for instance, and to say nothing of introspectionism and psychoanalysts and Gestalt. There were all these different schools, and those schools of thought were quite a lot like philosophical schools of thought, not like just different approaches to laboratory science. So the philosophy, you can't do science without doing philosophy. You can do it without paying any attention to the fact that you're making philosophical commitments, and you may get lucky. You don't have to be self-conscious and study it. But if you don't just want to chance your luck, it might pay to see what the philosophers of science in your field have to say.
So in you've displayed why it's useful for science. So for scientists who are engaged in practice, what's the sort of philosophical ideas that you think are most useful to them? Is it at the experimental level, or is it just about how to structure the knowledge that they're creating? Because at the edge, you don't know where the bits of knowledge go. And there's a sort of element of sort of epistemology to this. How do I know that I know this stuff? Mm-hmm. It gets a bit gnarled and knotty, doesn't it? So yeah, you can understand why they don't pay attention to it.
I actually think that the sort of grander epistemological questions of how we can be sure and what evidence and so forth are not as important to day-to-day science. They're important, but they're not the ones that I think philosophy can really help with, oddly enough. I take delight in suggesting experiments, helping design experiments. I've done this in a number of fields. Then I can be really quite sure that this is value added.
Can you give an example?
I was at a workshop in Berlin, the Dahlem Conference on Animal Intelligence, and there were ethologists there who were trying to break away from behaviorism and scratching their head about how their science could proceed. And this was all quite new to me, but I suggested that I had this idea, the intentional stance, which might help them design experiments. And I trotted it out in about 10 or 15 minutes at that workshop, and happily, a couple of them said, "Oh, now if that's a good idea, it should help us design experiments. Will it?" I said, "Let's see." We sat down over lunch and in an hour and a half designed several suites of experiments that were later carried out with very interesting and important results. And that was a tremendous boost to that idea. Led to the paper, Intentional Systems in Cognitive Ethology and Behavioral Brain Sciences, which really set the pace on that topic for a number of years. So that was a case of a philosopher confronting scientists who were very dissatisfied with the behaviorist strictures that they'd been trained in and didn't know where to turn.
Do you think that scientists know that they're in these strictures when they're in a particular school of thought?
Yeah, sometimes they don't. And it's then a rather thankless task to try to convince them that they're actually missing a trick. It's much better, I think, if you're going to be patient, to wait till they realize that these things aren't very easy. One of my ignoble joys of recent years has been to see scientists who just a few years earlier were unabashedly heaping scorn on philosophy. Then they try to solve the problem of consciousness and write books and articles about it and just fall on their faces, just make fools of themselves. Then they kind of realize these are harder issues. Maybe the philosophers have something to teach us after all.
Well, consciousness is one of the sort of subjects towards the in the last half of your book. You talk about the philosophical tools around things like free will, consciousness, evolution. Why are these particular subjects so amenable to philosophical ideas, given there's tons and tons of quite incredible scientific research going on? Why are these things so amenable? Or is it that there's something about those subjects, or is it your particular interest?
Well, let's look at consciousness. A lot of people think it's the sort of last great mystery, the area where there's least understanding about what on earth this phenomenon can be. So that would suggest that the questions that are being asked are often the wrong questions. And I've made that claim quite boldly and said, yes, most of the people working on this are in one way or another misimagining what the problem is and thinking that somewhere deep in the brain there's got to be a place where the spike trains are transduced into some other medium, and that's where the consciousness happens. And I call this Cartesian materialism. It's not the mistake of considering the pineal gland to be the fax machine to the soul, but it's saying, well, no, that's silly. But it's dimly imagining that there's some place in the brain where the consciousness happens. That's a first water mistake, but it's very seductive, and people fall in it all the time. And pointing that out is an interesting and, I think, valuable task. And people are learning how to avoid those errors and come up with models that can do some real work and that are explanatory. And there's still plenty of philosophical quandaries that surround this. It's by far it's far from being consensus about how to approach them. But I think it's just obvious that the difficulty of the problem of consciousness in the brain, the difficulties are really philosophical.
So how we think about the problem in the first place.
How we think about it, yeah.
The idea that you can list a whole bunch of tools to help people's lives get better, essentially, what your book tries to do. Is it a case of thinking, well, philosophical and scientific ideas can make your life better? Is that what you're trying to do? Or is it more of a greatest hits collection of mm-hmm. your ideas?
Well, it's a bit of both. I decided that I've been in the racket for 50 years. I've developed a lot of techniques. I think that philosophers are, oddly enough, famous navel gazers that we are, oddly unselfconscious about their methods. And I thought, I am going to draw attention to my methods, to the tools I use, to how I make them, to how I repair them, to how I think about them, and encourage others to get in the habit of watching the moves, sort of like a magician learning a new trick. I think these are not tricks in any bad sense. They're good tricks. They are ways of persuading people. And the more we understand how people can be persuaded, the better we'll do. We'll both protect ourselves against having the wool pulled over our eyes, and we will also enhance our own powers of persuasion. That makes thinking look like a sort of contact sport, a group sport. It's always opponent processes. I think that's right. I think we should appreciate that too, that even in science, we actually count on the opposition between different points of view to stabilize on the truth.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That was Daniel Dennett. His book is Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. It's published by Alan Lane and is available now. That's all we have for you this week. From me, Alok Chha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.